Chapter 6.
It would be hours before we made it all the way into the core, where we could take time to make final calculations prior to making the last jump to Fex. We had time to kill, and Akari whipped out a couple of frozen Nerf steaks from the galley's freezer. Fancy, I noted.
Enjoy it now. We'll be choking down protein sludge after this.
She put me in charge of all things Nerf, and pointed to a collection of vegetables she had stashed away, which she would be preparing. It was only enough for one meal. Everything else, as she said, would be protein and nutrient rations of one kind or another.
Why do you bring so little real food?
I asked her.
Jobs like this one usually don't give you enough time to prepare it or enjoy it. We'll be working non-stop and on alert at all times once we hit atmosphere. Food's just fuel, then.
Okay, but why not save something for when the job's through?
That feels like celebrating prematurely, and my desire for real food just pushes me to get home as fast as possible.
It turned out neither of us was particularly skilled in the culinary arts.
You sure can thaw a Nerf steak,
was about all Nakari could muster as a tribute after taking the first bite of my cooking. She was right. I had thoroughly thawed that Nerf, then kept going until I had burned it into a dry, tough piece of leather. I speared a root on my fork and regarded it doubtfully as it sagged on either end. It should have kept its shape.
Wow, these vegetables are really steamed, I said.
We eyed each other for a couple of seconds to see if either would take offense, then broke into laughter and said, sorry, at the same time.
After our meal, the armor begged to be tried on. The body was a strong but fairly lightweight insulated mesh, padded and reinforced on the torso and spine, designed to stop kinetic rounds and claws, I supposed. The helmets, by contrast, were almost absurdly heavy and cumbersome. We first had to put on a thick rubber insulation mask that the instructions claimed would shield us from the inevitable use of stun sticks to our own heads. It swept down across our collarbones and across the breadth of our shoulders. Then the helmet was fitted on top of that, so heavy that maintaining balance would be a problem. Any sudden movement forward or backward would tug your body in that direction, as I demonstrated by trying to look down. Nakari threw her head back to laugh at me and fell backward, pawing unsuccessfully at the walls to keep herself upright. We both toggled our comms and laughed at each other. Remember that guy on Pasher as we got on board? I said. He advised that we practice somersaults in these.
No way that's going to happen, Nakari said. He must have been messing with us.
Yeah, because I'm not sure I can get up now.
What? Whoa, that could be a problem.
It was a problem, though not an insurmountable one. We managed to regain our feet, but not quickly, and not without considerable strain. If we went down on Fex, we would not spring back up again. Running for more than a few steps might be impossible.
Did they even test these before giving them to us?
I wondered aloud, steadying myself against the walls of the passageway.
We should try out the stun sticks, Nakari suggested.
Agreed. If we can't take a hit now, think of what kind of mess we'll be in on the surface of Fex. We'll wind up like that first crew, and maybe the second, too.
Who goes first?
Go ahead and try it on me, I said. It's only fair. I ruined the Nerf steaks.
Very well. They shall be avenged.
She staggered over to the case of stun sticks and pulled out two, flipping them both on. The air around them rippled for a moment with an energy field and then settled.
Lurching toward me and grinning through her visor, Nakari reached out with her right hand and thwacked me on the pate, which I could feel but hardly hear inside the helmet.
Her voice crackled through the comm.
Anything?
I'm not unconscious, so that's good, I said.
Copy that. Double strike incoming!
Both sticks pounded on the top of my helmet, but I felt only the indications of a soft impact. She wasn't striking hard and shouldn't have to.
No effect, I said, encouraged. Try the sides and the visor, too.
Experimentation continued, and we discovered that the visors were not as well shielded. The stun stick didn't knock me out, but I did feel a shock, jerk away involuntarily, and then topple backward from the weight of the helmet.
Okay, good to know, I said.
Good to know they work, that's for sure,
Nakari said as she helped me up.
I'm going to have a ton of notes on these suits for my father, but I think they should keep us alive long enough to stun anything that lands on us.
We had enough empty hours ahead that some rack time was not only feasible, but advisable. So we took advantage and asked R2 to wake us when he was ready to jump into the deep core. He did so, and after we guzzled some black, bitter instant calf that succeeded in clearing our heads while savaging our taste buds, I annoyed him by asking to triple-check his coordinates with the Desert Jewel's nav computer. It took him less than 10 seconds, but he sounded affronted. Sorry, R2, but I've never jumped into the deep core before. It's crowded in there, and things move fast, and this isn't a well-established route yet, so I think an abundance of caution is warranted. That seemed to mollify him, and I let him take us in for the jump. It was only 15 minutes until the white lines of the stars collapsed into pinpoints again, and we were in the Shaw-Carat system. A red sun and a black planet crisscrossed with a web of crazed orange faults. Fex appeared from orbit to be a serene contrast to the angry planet. A cool, soft plum scoop of ice cream. The whole system was beautiful from orbit, and since we were in the deep core, the sky was thick with stars. I reminded R2 to take Hollows for the benefit of the Alliance, even though we wouldn't use Fex as a base. Maybe the orbit itself would be useful. I wanted to remember it regardless. We were among the first ever to see Shaw-Carat and Fex in person. Nakari sent the signal to activate the Harvester's beacon, and we set a course for it as soon as our sensors picked it up. While the Jewel took us in on autopilot, we climbed into our bulky armor, but decided to leave the helmets until it was time to open the airlock. We followed the beacon signal down to a plain of lavender grasses on the edge of a forest. A canopy of leaves like purple cotton perched on toothpicks. The Harvester rested there, seemingly undamaged from the outside.
So far, so good,
Nakari said, landing the Desert Jewel on the far side, putting the Harvester between us and the forest.
Nothing can drop down on us going from ship to ship.
Scans revealed life forms inside, but not enough to make up the entire crew of the Harvester. Attempts to raise them via comm failed, so we had no choice but to investigate in person. Swathed in our armor and practically teetering from the weight on our necks and shoulders, we set armored boots on the surface of Fex and trudged toward the ship. Stun sticks in each hand and blasters on hips. R2 burbled something that might have been an admonition to be careful as the ramp closed behind us. The Harvester was a Corellian XS-800 light freighter, with entry allowed from the ground via a ventral airlock situated behind the cockpit and in front of the living quarters, and also via two loading elevators to the cargo areas nestled on either side of the ship.
Cargo areas first. Agreed?
Yeah.
We approached the portside cargo bay, and Akari sent remote codes to call down the freight elevator. It descended flawlessly and without any bodies on it, which was encouraging. The platform had a rudimentary console connected to the rest of the ship, and Akari punched in codes to light up the interior. Hydraulics whined as we rose together, though we didn't see much at first beyond the glow panels and cargo hooks in the ceiling. Might there be a Fexian skull borer perching up there even now, invisible to our eyes?
Stun sticks ready?
She asked.
Ready.
The clanking of our boots on the deck sounded muffled and far away, like someone else was walking elsewhere in the ship. A pallet of crates shrouded in tarpaulin hunched in one forward corner as the elevator stopped.
but farther aft, along the right wall, a line of specimen crates with thick, clear glass was stacked three high, like one might see in a pet merchant's stall. I doubted these held any promise of a nurturing relationship.
"Check the crates first. Leave nothing behind us," Nakari said.
The crates underneath the tarp turned out to be bulk food supplies, mostly protein sludge mixtures.
"It's our diet for the near future. Nothing more."
"Okay, let's head aft."
There was an airtight hatch back there, leading to a machine shop, bathrooms, and the galley, and from there to the other cargo bay on the opposite side. Or we could go forward through the common area and living quarters to see what waited for us on the bridge. As we drew closer, most of the specimen crates were empty and inactive, save for 10 closest to the hatch. We clumped our way forward to get a better look and saw that 5 of them in the middle row contained Fexian skull borers lying on their sides. Unconscious for sure, since we could see them, but more likely dead.
"You know, this makes me wonder," Nakari said. "How do you keep a Fexian skull borer alive in captivity? Does anybody sell brain chow on the market?"
"I'm sure butchers would be able to supply nerve brains or something like that," I said.
"Ugh.
The skull borers might find them delicious."
"Uh-oh, Luke. Look at this."
"What?"
Nakari pointed at the top 5 containers closest to the aft exit of the cargo bay. The thick polymer glass in these, much like our visors, had been cut through in narrow arcs with uneven edges. The units were still functioning and that the glow panels in the lids, calibrated to mimic the UV light and radiation from Shah Karat's star, remained on and warm. But the containers, clearly occupied at one time, no longer held any residence.
"I bet the glass is all over the floor. But I don't want to look down or I might join it,"
Nakari said. I thought the debris might be more like chunks than shards. The glass was quite thick and might in fact be a clear polycarbonate.
"That means we have 5 skull borers loose in the ship?"
"Maybe. If we're lucky, they just snuck out past us, real quiet and invisible, when we lowered the freight elevator."
"Not sure if we're that lucky."
"Nope. But I wonder why only the top 5 escaped and not these 5 below them."
"Maybe one figured out it could bore through the glass and the others saw what it did and copied it."
"Okay, that's plausible. The ones below wouldn't have seen anything except maybe the glass falling."
"Or the ones in the bottom cages might have already been dead."
"True. I actually hope that was the case. Because whether the 5 on top followed a leader or acted independently, that implies a level of intelligence I'd rather not face. Let's press on. We need to find the crew. There were 6 of them. Maybe they'll respond to a shipwide announcement."
She stepped forward to the aft hatch leading to the rest of the freighter, which we noticed was partially open. It had tried to close automatically and failed, prevented from doing so by the booted right foot of someone.
"Oh no,"
Nakari said.
"That means they got into the rest of the ship."
"That it does. But maybe someone's locked away somewhere."
Using the console pad on the wall by the hatch, she toggled the comm.
"Harvester, this is a rescue crew sent by Kellen Biolabs. We are in the port cargo bay. If anyone is alive, please respond."
She lifted her finger away, and we waited for a reply. Nothing. She repeated the message, and we waited again, in vain.
"All right, we press on,"
she said to me, pushing the button to open the hatch, and then bracing herself against the hatch edge so that she could look down without being pulled off balance. I did the same on the other side of the hatch. A Saurian lay face down in a standard Kellen Biolabs uniform. Bareheaded, in other words, with 2 holes in the back of his conical skull, one for each of his 2 brains.
"They weren't wearing armor," I said. "They thought they were safe on the ship with the skull borers locked away."
"Wonder how long he's been here,"
Nakari said.
"Same as the others,"
I replied.
How do you mean?
This ship never took off, but it's still functional. The skull borers either killed everyone or isolated them from the bridge. Otherwise, you can bet it wouldn't still be sitting here like this.
Nakari's lips pressed together into a thin line through her visor.
Okay. We go from room to room together, clearing each and locking it behind us.
Can they bore through the hatches?
That would be excellent intel to have right now. We'll see. Let's check all the way aft first. Maybe someone made it into an escape pod.
I stepped past her into the next chamber, an all-purpose area that had some scientific equipment set up. It had a bathroom and a galley. Both were unoccupied. The armor that the crew should have been wearing was piled in a corner next to the bathroom, and the infrared goggles that would have allowed the crew to see the creatures and wouldn't fit our helmets were stowed in a box underneath a table. In the center of the back wall was a pair of doors that led to the engineering area and the escape pods. A rudimentary machine shop was incorporated in the engineering area, and it had been thrashed by someone desperate for any kind of weapon. And that someone was dead, face down like the Saurian, but with a wrench within centimeters of his right hand. Nakari gasped when she saw the body.
I know him. Knew him.
Was he the pilot?
No, a scientist. I was on a collection crew with him once.
I don't see any blood on the wrench, I said. Though I don't know what skull borer blood looks like. Impossible to tell if he scored a hit with it or not.
If he wasn't already holding it, and the skull borer landed on his unprotected head, he probably wouldn't have had time enough, considering how fast they drilled through armor.
I winced.
Good point.
Moving in tandem, we checked both escape pods and the remainder of the engineering compartment. No more crew, and no dead skull borer bodies.
Nakari?
What?
It's likely there's one in here, right? The door was closed.
Not necessarily. It could have escaped when someone else entered or left. And we can't assume they're too dim to figure out the doors. The crew might not have coded them locked and simply allowed them to function with the press of a button. The creatures were smart enough to bore out of their cages in an organized fashion.
At least one row of them was.
Yeah. Well, nothing's jumped on us, and you have to think anything trapped in here would be hungry. So let's call this clear and move forward. But we'll do the starboard cargo bay before we head up into the living quarters and the bridge.
Okay.
We exited the engineering compartment, and Nakari strode to the starboard cargo bay doors, which she tried to open with a single touch. A red light stopped her, and a chirp demanded the full code. She carefully punched it in with one hand while bracing two stun sticks in the other. The doors slid aside, and I stepped in, arms out for balance as much as readiness. The bay contained more pallets of equipment and a couple of speeder bikes coated in lavender dust, but no bodies of any kind, and no brain-sucking predators that we could see. Considering their natural camouflaging abilities, I wondered if we had truly cleared the room so far, or merely caught them napping. If a skull borer remained quiet, how would we know it was there?
You know, after we clear the ship this way, I want to go through it again with just one stun stick and a portable scanner to make sure we didn't miss any that might be hiding.
Good call. Ready to go forward?
Yeah. How many cabins?
8 of them. 4 on each side of the hallway leading to the bridge. But first there should be a common lounge area.
Her fingers hovered over the data pad next to the door.
All set?
Raising my arms, I said,
Go!
And she pressed the door release. It wasn't locked like the cargo bay doors, so it slid aside quickly and gave me my first view of the carnage. There were 3 bodies. One of them, a jowly, thick-lipped Sulliston male, was still seated in a lounge chair with a data pad in his lap, the large orbs of his eyes open and filmed over in death. He'd been killed before he could get up. A human female slumped lifeless near the hatch leading to the cabins, and nearby a horned Zabrak male lay face down, blocking the door leading to the medical bay. The back of his head, an open, bloody mess. Albeit a dry mess at this point.
"They have to be in here,"
I said, moving forward to allow Nakari to follow me inside.
"Some of them, anyway."
The helmet wouldn't allow a decent range of motion, but I saw some scratches and smears of blood high up on the bulkheads. The skull borers couldn't camouflage their tracks. The door hissed shut behind us, and I paused, expecting an attack at any second. But the time ticked by, and none came.
"Let's secure the medical bay before we go forward," Nakari said.
Zabrak have some horns on their heads, but they are short and stubby, and obviously no deterrent to a skull borer, since they don't grow on the vulnerable pate. The Zabrak's body was half out of the bay, like the Saurian we had seen earlier. He'd been trying to exit, perhaps seeking help, when the skull borer brought him down. Peering past his body into the bay, I could see an examination table and the metal arms of various scanners and surgical tools. Such bays were customized for multi-species crews like this one and packed full of instruments and medicines that a human would never need. I thought that the tangle of apparatus suspended over the examination table would be attractive to creatures that liked to lounge in branches waiting for prey to walk by.
"That door should open up fully without a code, since it never closed."
"Got it."
I thumped the console with my elbow, and the door slid wide, allowing me to step past the body of the Zabrak. Three steps in, I felt something land on my head.
"They're in here!"
I shouted as I whipped the stun sticks at my head from either side. The one on my left hit nothing but helmet, but the right one made contact with something, with a bit more give to it, like flesh. No squeal or anything, but the extra weight slid off and plopped onto my shoulder, which startled me. I moved my head too fast to get a look at it as it fell, and the unwieldy helmet pulled me off balance. I managed to stagger backward and get my hands down to control the fall, but the fall was inevitable, and as soon as I hit the ground, two more weights landed on me in quick succession, right on my visor, though I saw nothing. A white circle of abraded polymer appeared directly above my left eye, and I could hear the material scream as it was torn to shreds by the invisible creature drilling directly toward my head. Its teeth would have no trouble plowing through my eye and then to my brain directly behind. I pounded at the area with each of my stun sticks, but the drilling continued as a body became visible, and I lost a couple of precious seconds realizing what had happened. One skull borer had landed on top of the other, draping over it protectively. And while I had stunned that one to unconsciousness, the first one was still invisible and hungry for my gray matter. I couldn't get to it with the stun sticks, and meanwhile the drilling continued with palpable progress. Dropping the stun sticks, I grabbed for my blaster and didn't bother to check its setting. I leveled the barrel on a plane even with the outside of my visor and pulled the trigger, letting rip a bolt of red plasma that momentarily blinded me but halted the shriek of drilling. It also left a scorch mark across my visor.
"Luke, are you okay?"
Nakari asked.
"Yeah, three down, right?"
"I'll say. No problem seeing them after you blast them. There's nasty purple goo all over the bay now."
"What about the first one I stunned?"
Nakari dropped a stun stick and drew her blaster. She fired at the unconscious form out of my line of sight.
"He won't wake up either. I don't have any interest in bringing these things back alive. They've killed my friends."
"Friends?"
She gestured with her blaster.
"I knew this Zabrak, too. He knew how to cook."
Her eyes flashed at me behind her visor.
"Sorry. Didn't mean to imply criticism of your nerve stakes."
I hadn't even thought of that until she said it. Last thing on my mind, I'd been thinking that I knew all about what she was feeling right then. And the shock of seeing someone you know dead, one of the first things you think of is how you will remember them. Things like, he could cook, or
she could sing, or he was my best friend, and I'll miss him forever. The crush of grief rolls in behind that. But sometimes you can shove that in a closet for a while, until you have time to deal with it. I knew I still had plenty to deal with. I imagine Nakari was walling up her feelings like that now.
Not a problem,
I said.
Sorry about your friend. Give me a hand up.
Sure.
She holstered her blaster and strode forward, right hand extended, while her left still held a stun stick. She had to balance herself carefully to lean down, but before I could take her hand, she reared back from me, her left hand bashing the top of her right with the stunner. A skull borer appeared and slid off her hand as she simultaneously dropped the stun stick and screamed. She yanked out her blaster and shot at the back of her left hand, killing another of the creatures and taking some of her own blood with it.
Ah!
Dropping her blaster, she clutched her injured hand to her chest.
Why did they attack my hands?
I rolled over and levered myself up to a standing position.
They're smart, just like you thought. Problem solvers. They saw us kill the other three using things in our hands, so they attack the hands to disable you, and then they can get to what they really want.
Oh, you're right. These things are at least semi-sentient. We shouldn't be messing around with them. Except this last one, who's only stunned. Would you mind?
I considered simply dropping it outside the ship, but it wouldn't do to have it lingering around where it could attack us again when we had to return to the jewel. I shot it, and that made 5 dead skull borers to match up with 5 empty cages.
At least you're already in the medical bay. Let's see if we can patch you up.
The skull borer had chewed through her glove like tissue and had sawn through the web of tendons in the back of her hand, though it didn't break any of the bones. Nakari had blasted it to jelly before it could drill so far. It was impossible for her to make a fist now. I slapped a back-to-patch on it, gave her something for the pain, and let the automated medical system continue from there. She'd need a true surgeon to repair the damage, but the system could keep her stable and free of infection.
I'm going to check the rest of the ship, just in case. We should still have 1 crew member left, right?
Nakari nodded, biting her lower lip. The pain medication probably hadn't kicked in yet, and her adrenaline was wearing off.
I'll be back as soon as I can. I want to see if I can get the ship fired up, too.
I don't know how you can see anything,
she said, breathing quickly.
Between that chewed-up spot in the visor and the burn, it's a wonder you're not blind.
I'll be careful. I'm taking 2 sticks with me, just in case.
Nakari requested that I give her one of hers, and only when she felt sufficiently armed did she lie back on the table to let the medical program run. She quizzed me on the codes for the doors before I exited. Though my theories would probably be laughable to anyone with a better knowledge of biology, I wondered if the skull borers might get smarter depending on what they ate. Would the prions and neurons of their meals accrete somehow and improve their thinking?
If such a thing were possible, maybe eating the double brain of a Saurian would explain how their tactics adapted and improved, because they had been pursuing a tactical strategy by going after Nakari's hands.
And come to think of it, when they attacked my face, the way that one of them landed on top of the other was clever too. I couldn't get to the one on the bottom using the stun sticks, and they hadn't seen the blasters get used yet, so they wouldn't have been able to account for that. But that possibility raised other questions. The one that landed on the other's back would have necessarily been punctured by the first one's spines. So if that had been planned, it had been a planned sacrifice. Could they even see each other while camouflaged? Maybe that 1-2 business had been a complete accident. The 2 that attacked Nakari had obviously coordinated their attack, though, which made me wonder how they communicated. We had heard no vocalizations from them until we caused them pain. The simplest explanation, and far more likely than the idea that they could get smarter by eating brains, was that the skull borers were at least semi-sentient, maybe even sentient to begin with. But between them killing the first 2 collection crews, and me and Nakari killing them back, we had never had time to puzzle out their status. All of my questions were better answered by Kellen Biolabs, and I was more than ready to drop the entire mess into their lap. I tapped the code into the datapad that would unlock the hatch to the living quarters. No bodies awaited me in the hallway, but I had to step over the fallen body of the human female outside the door to enter it.
All the quarters were closed, and I punched in the override for each one, finding the first two on either side empty, albeit with signs of recent occupation.
Papers on desks, half-empty cups of calf, tossed linens, and a carelessly discarded pair of underwear in one case. I found the sixth and final member of the Harvester's crew behind the third hatch on the left. He was a human male, curled up on his bunk, most likely dead, his lips cracked and dry, and his skin gone pale. Though his skull was still intact, he hadn't responded to Nakari's shipwide calls when he had the requisite equipment to do so. I checked. The console by the door still worked. Perhaps he had locked himself in here once he realized the skull borers were loose on the ship and knew that he couldn't venture outside the room without his armor. Several empty water bulbs lay strewn about the floor, but I saw no food packets. Who knew the last time he'd had a drink or something to eat? He'd chosen to die of thirst rather than have his brain sucked up a feeding tube. An understandable decision. I saw an old-fashioned handwritten diary open on his desk, which would no doubt illuminate his last days. Just to make sure, I knelt beside him and leaned forward until my visor was right next to his open mouth and nose. After a couple of seconds, the glass unmistakably fogged. He still breathed. He had to be near death, though. I had to get him to the medical bay immediately. Turning off the stun stick in my left hand, I placed it on his desk and then tried to prod him awake with a few finger jabs. He didn't respond. So I turned off the other stun stick and put it down, threw him awkwardly over my left shoulder, then grabbed a stun stick in my right hand before returning to the medical bay.
Nakari, I found someone,
I said as I entered. A pair of robot arms suspended from the ceiling was wrapping up her left hand in a thick protective shroud of bandages.
Still alive?
She asked.
Yeah, but he's in bad shape.
Well, it's finished with me anyway,
she said, her words languorous and mellow. The medication must have kicked in. She waved at the medical apparatus hanging above her with her damaged hand.
It can do the surgery required for something like this. These things are meant to keep you alive, and mending tendons isn't on their list of vital services.
She rose from the examination bed to make room, and I slid the man onto it.
Know him too?
I asked, once she could see his face.
No.
She shook her head.
But I'm sure my father will be glad to get him back.
Mind looking after him? I'd like to clear the rest of the ship.
Absolutely. You do that,
she replied, and plopped herself into a chair resting against the wall. She didn't look entirely lucid, so I programmed the autodock to begin its work on the man before I left him. The remaining cabins were empty, and the bridge was pristine. I wasn't attacked at any point, so I thumbed the shipwide comm and said,
Nakari, the ship is clear. At least without scanning. I will start up the engines and run pre-flight, then come back through with a scanner to make doubly sure.
She acknowledged, and then the work began. The Harvester was okay on fuel, and all systems were nominal, except for the profound lack of a crew at the moment. I dragged all the victims into the holding area between the galley and the bathroom, where their unused armor was, then returned briefly to the Desert Jewel to fetch a small lifeform scanner to scan the Harvester thoroughly. It was truly clear, so I asked Nakari what she'd like to do next.
How are we getting this ship out of here?
Link it to the Desert Jewel's nav, and you fly us all back to Pasha. I'll stay on board in case this guy wakes up and try to clean up some of this mess.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. We better get paid really well for this.